Good afternoon, everyone. I'd like to call the Senate Transportation Committee to order at 1:31 p.m. Today is February 7th, 2019. And today we have present Senator Keel and myself, Chair Hughes, and we have Senator Machicki on the way. Senator Wilson is presenting a bill in another committee. So please silence or turn off your cell phones. And thank you, Carrie and Madison, for helping us here in the room with what you do so well, and Amy, our aide. Today we're going to have a presentation from with DOT and with our state seismologist on the November 30th earthquake, how it happened, how it was monitored, then how it affected our roads and our public facilities. And we'll begin today with a presentation by Dr. Mike West, state seismologist and director of the Alaska Earthquake Center at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. And then we'll follow that, bringing the DOT folks up, who we will introduce at that time. We also have some people online, and we'll tell you who those are, too, once DOT comes up. And so, Dr. West, you're already in place. Please state your name for the record and begin your presentation.
Thank you very much. Michael West, a state seismologist. I direct the Alaska Earthquake Center. And I appreciate the opportunity to talk to you all today. You may or may not know the Alaska Earthquake Center, but you absolutely know the products and things that we provide for the state. So I wanted to give you a brief introduction there and then move on to talk about some aspects of the November 30th earthquake. Things that we are probably known for most are the rapid assessments of earthquakes when they do occur, very basic parameters such as where an earthquake occurred, how large it was, and what the extent of impact, or rather strong ground motion and shaking was. These are things that we provide in the minutes after an earthquake and then continue over the coming days and weeks. If you've been in any of our coastal communities, then you've also seen most likely evacuation signs or signs that map out the hazard zone for tsunamis. Those are installed based on tsunami zones, safe zones, unsafe zones, which are determined through research and products put out also by the Alaska Earthquake Center.
Dr. West, before you go, could you actually go back to the first slide? And I attended the lunch and learn and was trying not to dominate that with my question. I wanted to give those attending a chance. But I do have a question, because some of us have added an app to our phone maybe since the earthquake, or maybe we're monitoring it. But we've probably all noticed where a report will come out on the intensity of an earthquake, and then it'll be typically downgraded later, sometimes, I suppose, upscaled. But so why are we seeing an initial report and then something fine-tuned? How does that work? And do you do both of those, the initial?
That's an excellent question. Those are a glimpse, I suppose, into the workings of what we do. Imagine when an earthquake happens and shaking begins to be recorded in a lot of different places. We've got recordings from here. We've got some from over here, maybe some from here. And we begin to put those together, and we have an initial assessment. But there are many different ways to measure an earthquake, different ways to measure magnitude, and I won't drag you through a long technical detail explanation of that. But it's something that, as more data becomes available, as the magnitude, the location of an earthquake, or at least our assessment of it, changes. I know that causes consternation amongst the population sometimes, but that's because we're putting out information very, very fast. The very first reports you will see, you see information within a couple of minutes. No human has reviewed that data yet. That's something that's being done through computer algorithms. And as an analyst goes through, adds data, removes data, tweaks this, changes that, that evolves. For larger earthquakes like this, actually there can be some debate that can extend days or even weeks after the earthquake. So these are, a magnitude is a best assessment, and that's it's all dependent on the data available. I don't know if that addresses your question or not.
It does. Thank you so much. I want to note on the record that Senator Machicki joined just a few moments ago. And so for this one, I think I did Did I see at some point 7.1 maybe or 7.2 or?
Oh, very likely. Very likely.
But we've settled on 7.0. Is that correct?
Actually, I'm not going to say that on the record. There continues to be debate because it is very close. It basically is on the borderline between 7.0 and 7.1. And there is a vibrant discussion going on, not just amongst us, but amongst other agencies globally who worked on this earthquake. And there's some chance that that would actually be reviewed.
Thank you.
Revised, rather. So. Anyway, the third thing that I think is an important takeaway from the Earthquake Center is the research to explain where and why different earthquakes happen. This is a map showing the 55,000 events, seismic events, that were large enough to be reported in 2018. Now, most of these are very small, inconsequential events, but they do paint a picture for us. Some earthquakes within that are sort of our usual suspects, and other things catch us by surprise. And when something catches us by surprise, like the magnitude 7.9 earthquake that occurred offshore Kodiak back in January, triggered tsunami warnings and other things, that's an event that we were not anticipating. So there's considerable research and analysis to try and put that in perspective and specifically figure out what that means for the future. So, who cares? I would summarize this very simply. Those data from the past few slides are used in developing building codes. They're used in the environmental review process for any kind of major projects. They help determine your insurance rates. They determine the evacuation routes and where shelters and evacuation centers should be in our coastal communities. And any community that has a hazard mitigation plan most likely has chapters dedicated within it to the seismic and or tsunami component. So I'm going to skip forward, skip a slide, I think, and go to the legislature side there, which I think is important because you could ask quite reasonably why we do what we do. And I want to reinforce to this group that it's because the legislature tells us to. We have statute that determines, sets our general direction and sets our responsibility to report to you. And that is under the leadership of a state seismologist, a role that I happen to be filling right now. And the reason I point that out is that I very much view, though I am an employee of the university, an employee of the Geophysical Institute, in many ways I work for you guys. So as issues come up, as questions come up, this hearing is a perfect example. I hope you will view us as a state resource. How's this done? We operate a network of monitoring stations across the state. There are about 150. The majority are operated by us, but we have some partners as well in this activity. When there is any kind of a seismic event, the recordings from each one of those sites stream data. Actually, they're always streaming data live into our headquarters in Fairbanks, where that's all assimilated into earthquake reports. An individual station looks something like this with a power system, a sensor in the ground, and most importantly, radio communication, some type of communication that brings that data back live, which is a good technical challenge during the winters on the North Slope or coastal storms or out in the Aleutians. But this is actually perhaps the thing we're internally most proud of is the engineering keeps all this running. All right, at the Earthquake Center in Fairbanks, where all of this data is coming in at one time, I view us very much as sort of taking the pulse, if you will, of Alaska, because quite literally anything that moves the ground in a significant way is something that we see roll through in our data. One little example I would provide for you would be a brief snippet of the aftershocks from the November 30th earthquake. This is just 40 minutes of data taken later that morning. And it gives you some sense. Each one of those lines is a different recording station. And you see all the blips up and down. There's probably 50 aftershocks in that brief period of time. That is the foundation for what we do.
Senator Michicki has a question.
Thank you, Mr. West. Dr. West?
Mm-hmm.
Mr. West?
Dr.
Who has suddenly become a star and, Normally, I would think a seismologist is being a really invisible line of work.
You try.
So why is it an aftershock and not just another earthquake or a continuous earthquake? It seems, it was confusing to some of us when we started, we're still hitting the 5.1s or so and hitting above 4 for several days. Why is it not a continuous earthquake until it settles down?
Let me phrase it this way, perhaps. An aftershock is just an ordinary, run-of-the-mill earthquake. They are, in fact, no different. But we know very well that when a large earthquake happens, you've moved the ground. You've put the earth in some new position, and it has to adjust. And that adjustment process breeds many more earthquakes, generally smaller. We know that those happen because you feel them, right? We know that they're traceable back to that original earthquake, so we refer to them as aftershocks. But they are, in fact, no different.
One more follow-up. And I know that it's typical that there's an earthquake of more significant seismicity than the aftershocks, but are there ever precursor aftershocks as the plate's really kind of getting ready to go? That does it ever go the other way?
It does. When an earthquake occurs, it triggers other earthquakes, generally smaller, but there is always a small statistical chance that it would trigger, would be the word we use, a larger one. When we look globally, depending on exactly where you are, the chance of that happening is 1 to 5%. Very roughly speaking, and that is always out there as a possibility after an earthquake. But it does vary depending on where you are, and you have to look around and say, well, is there something reasonable that might be triggered by this?
And I will say, after I downloaded the application and was monitoring in the few weeks, there was one. I want to say it was in the South Pacific, and it was far enough away from the islands, I don't think there was a big problem, but I want to say it was somewhere between a 7 and a 7.2, and then shortly thereafter, maybe a couple hours later, there was a 7.9. So it does happen, and I probably would have been better off had I not noticed that, because it made me more nervous because I knew that was a possibility.
What I would stress, though, is that even before an earthquake like November 30th, we knew that we lived with that potential of something larger, whether triggered or not. So, does that help?
Senator Keel had a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Professor, back a couple slides, you had partners listed in the monitoring network, and I think I figured out who U.S. is. Can you help me out with who the other ones are?
The Alaska Volcano Observatory has significant instrumentation in the Aleutians. The Tsunami Warning Center has a handful of sites around the state. The U.S. Geological Survey has a couple of sensors, and then actually the Canadians are close partners. Earthquakes don't know political boundaries, and we collaborate very closely with them. Those are the major players.
Thank you.
One example, I guess what I wanted to walk you through is a few examples of how that data gets used. What is it? What are the decisions? What questions do people use this data to help with? One example would be along the pipeline. These are recordings from a magnitude 7.1 earthquake, you may recall, back in 2016. And these are real recordings from each of the pump stations. And these data are used to help prioritize where engineering resources, where inspections should be focused, and where we don't need to worry. Alyeska is just one example of a group that uses the recordings to prioritize where to spend their time and where they don't need to. A lot of questions that we've been answering over the last couple of weeks to try and put perspective on the November 30 earthquake, like the questions that have come up today. A recurring question is this a worst case event? Have we learned what we need to know from this earthquake? And I would the answer to that is it's undoubtedly a learning experience. But we only need to look at our own history to recognize that it is not a worst-case event by any means. larger earthquakes are statistically not common, but 1964 demonstrates quite clearly the other kinds of activity that we can have. What I think the lesson in this is, maybe we'll revisit this at the end, is that the next earthquake will undoubtedly look different from this one. Whatever patterns we have, whatever the patterns of ground shaking, the next earthquake will surprise us in some way.
Dr. West, because we're looking at the picture we've all seen that went viral, could you talk a little bit? We were talking in my office about this and why. In my home, for instance, there was tremendous everything. It took me 5 days, 12-hour days to put things and clean up broken glass and filing cabinets that fell over, bookshelves that fell over. Yet I spoke with friends that were only a mile away. One said she had a little vase roll off her table and didn't break. Someone else said they had one picture fall off the wall. Can you explain why in this picture we see such damage, but a mile down the road, we didn't? And just so people understand that, why the difference is in a close location.
It's with some trepidation that I have a picture of a road on a slide. I'll leave those things to the DOT folks, who will certainly have a lot more insight. But I think if we were to zoom out on this picture, it would be very insightful, right? As you know, there are a handful of areas that have attracted a lot of attention. But this is not what roads or houses looked like everywhere. There were very specific features that led to the response in areas like this. So if we zoomed out, we would see hundreds of yards, miles of road that had very little impact at all. The road is built largely the same. I leave that to others. But there were ground soil factors in particular places that led to different results. And the same thing happened in neighborhoods and around houses. In one neighborhood, not every house is built on the same soils or on the same, the same underlying geology. They respond differently.
So as you mentioned in my office, there's a difference between a bowl of Jell-O and maybe a bowl of ice cream. Jell-O's going to jiggle more. So because I think there was some talk that people were thinking things ran in certain veins under the ground, but really everything's pretty much shaking. It just has to do with whether it's on rocks or soil, what kind of soil. That's basically what you're saying?
This earthquake occurred 30 miles beneath the surface of the earth. Essentially, everywhere from Anchorage to Palmer to Wasilla to Willow experienced the same basic the same basic forces from the earthquake. The differences in area are largely a result of the geology where things are built. I'm not sure I addressed that.
It did. But. Thank you.
Okay. One of the other questions that's come up a lot recently is the potential for this kind of event elsewhere in the state. And again, the historical record gives us a very good foundation on which to address those. In the Juneau area or southeast, southeast is certainly capable of earthquakes of this size, actually considerably larger. But if you look at that inset for Juneau, what you'll see is that the vast majority of earthquakes occur a bit more out toward the coast. So, though a large earthquake is certainly possible, could well be felt in Juneau, it's likely to be a little further away. That's good. In the interior, there's plenty of history for magnitude 7 earthquakes. However, they do not occur as frequently as they do in South Central. So the answer for the Fairbanks region would be yes, but with less frequency. This another question, a set of questions we've been dealing with a lot, deal with aftershocks, and really the question that Senator Machiki asked a few minutes ago, the distinction between an aftershock and other earthquakes. I won't walk you through the technical details of this slide, but this is basically a projection based on the last 2 months of aftershocks that we anticipate, if that pattern holds, that about a year from now, the rate of aftershocks will be low enough that it will become hard to distinguish. It'll be hard to say, that's an aftershock compared to just, that's part of the background earthquakes that we are accustomed to living with. So that could change, but right now we've forecast that to be somewhere, you know, about a year from now. Another question, set of questions we've dealt a lot with are, where was the shaking strongest, and where was it lighter? This figure shows the ground motions. Wherever we see orange and warm colors, it's stronger shaking. Blue is lighter shaking. And if you look at the inset, I mentioned this point a moment ago, but Anchorage, Eagle River, Palmer, and the Wasilla, Willow sorts of areas, generally speaking, we're roughly about this, you know, very roughly about the same amount of shaking. So when we look at places like Eagle River, where there was disproportionately high damage relative to some other places, we need to begin to look for some other explanations. We can't pin all of that on the earthquake itself. I will point out, you'll see this in the same data in a few different flavors in the later presentations this afternoon. And this is a signature product, I would say, of the Earthquake Center. It's put out through, we redistribute through a lot of different groups, through the USGS and elsewhere. But I think it's important. This is actually something derived in-state with in-state resources.
Senator Michiki has a question.
And I'd really love to, if you have a white paper on earthquakes or something that gives more information. I don't need to take a lot of staff time, but are there categories of earthquakes that an Iowa freak earthquake periodically versus what we're subject to in Alaska that make Alaska more earthquake prone?
Through the chair, I suppose. There are very clear explanations and reasons for why Alaska is very earthquake prone. As you say, this may not be the time to go into the full detail, but I will certainly provide resources afterward. And actually, they're fairly straightforward.
And I would say too, because certain areas felt it, and you presented this morning, we learned from the Anchorage School District, the university, and the Matsu School District, and how the kind of damage that occurred in some schools where others got off, you know, fairly light. And it goes back to what you were saying about the soils, the rocks, the geology, but it also can be the structures themselves, that, you know, the difference in. Had the superintendents in my office from Matsu and Anchorage today, and the difference in the construction and when things were built, the type of whether the cement blocks were stacked up evenly or spaced in a way that they couldn't just separate straight down the line. There was a difference. In fact, the three schools that were hit, Gruning, Houston, and I'm forgetting the third, it was the construction where the cement blocks were lined up so they could break down evenly. So along with the geology, the structures, and the area, and that all has to be figured out. And I was going to ask you, as far as just a little bit as follow-up, as Iowa versus Alaska, so we understand why some of the schools or the homes were hit suffered more damage than in other places. Is there research being done right now on the geology and a comparison of the structures so that we will be better prepared in going forward to understand the geology and how it impacts the structures and how we might build things in the future to better withstand? I know that's not your area, but because you're in this world, are you aware of research that's being conducted that will help Alaska with that?
So if there's a silver lining to an event like this, it is that it's a rare opportunity to do that research, right? We don't get a lot of chances to examine the societal impacts of an earthquake like this. And so this earthquake generated tremendous interest from across the country and internationally. There were really, particularly in the engineering world, again, not my expertise, but there were many different teams of engineers, both from in-state and out-of-state, who came in, motivated, one, by helping Anchorage to assess, you know, what buildings were safe and what weren't, but really also motivated by the opportunity to learn from this. And that's exactly how our building codes advance. Building codes are evolving, ever-changing. They learn something that, you know, let's tweak it this way. Or this particular thing we weren't aware of seems to have failed. Let's revise that in future versions of the code. So absolutely, there's significant research ongoing. Professional societies having special publications about this, special meetings. That work will continue for years.
Yeah, that's reassuring. Thank you.
Yeah. In the interest of time, I might bump ahead a couple of slides. I want to make sure we have plenty of time for transportation, Department of Transportation colleagues. How about we move ahead to a slide that looks something like this. It shows a map of Alaska that a colleague of mine made that shows the monitoring network in white. And overlain on western Alaska is a map of California, which shows the instrumentation that is there. And I don't want to downplay the significance of California's earthquake risks, but they do work with a very different set of tools than are available in Alaska. I liken it to doing astronomy, you know, with looking at the stars with the Hubble telescope, seeing everything in crystal clarity versus at times in parts of Alaska, our knowledge of earthquakes is a bit like doing, you know, astronomy with a pair of binoculars. You kind of know some things are going on over there, but can't really see the details. And I wanted to give you a concrete example of that on the next slide. This is a brief introduction to the concept of earthquake early warning, which is an operational reality in Southern California right now, and soon to be operational. It's in testing right now across the entire west coast of the Alaska, Washington, or west coast of the U.S., Washington, Oregon, California. And you know, the basic premise of which is if you can detect an earthquake quickly enough and warn ahead of those seismic waves, you can actually provide some advanced notice to people. 5 seconds, 10 seconds, 30 seconds in rare cases, 60 seconds of forewarning.
For clarification, we're talking about western lower 48 U.S., not including Alaska, correct?
Yes, Chair. A term that I don't actually care for but is widely used in my community, West Coast, is used there to refer to California, Oregon, and Washington. Took me a few years to wrap my head around that, and we could go down that road. But anyway, I use this as an example of the kind of federal initiative, the kind of big things that are happening in this country that Alaska is not part of because we do not have the foundation on which to build such a thing.
And yet we have 4 out of 5 earthquakes occur in
Alaska. I did skip by that figure, but that's right. There's a pie chart in the figures there that demonstrates 4 out of 5 earthquakes in the United States occur here
in Senator Alaska. Senator Machicki.
So where do you put your money, in an early warning system of 10 or 15 seconds or in better engineering for structures and other safety precautions that have other benefits?
I would say that's an excellent question, and that's outside my expertise. I think that's the kind of thing that is right up y'all's alley. So I'm not going to argue one way or another. It's a very legitimate point. This is the monitoring network that I showed you a little earlier, and I was not entirely truthful in that the next slide shows what we're actually working with right now. We have our Hubble telescope at the moment. All of these yellow and or orange dots that populate the state are part of a massive temporary deployment by the National Science Foundation, not carried out by us, but we have been huge beneficiaries of this as they conduct it's a 3 or 4 year experiment in recording also high resolution data in the state. That goes away in 2020, and all of those dots will be removed, and we will revert back to the same monitoring network that we've had in the past,
which is the red dots, right?
That's right. I'm sorry, that's the red dots on there, built up over 50 years by our organization and others.
Senator Keel?
Does that mean I'm going to get fewer or less reliable tweets from your Earthquake Information Center?
That means you will get less reliable tsunami warnings. You will get less reliable tweets. You will get more jitter in the magnitude, wherever that question came from earlier. That's exactly right. Less clarity in the information. Less resolution in where the shaking was strong and where it wasn't. Those are exactly the impacts.
Dr. West, you had mentioned to me in an earlier meeting that the National Science Foundation has done this across the United States, and we're kind of the end of this project. And in a number of states, they've chosen to retain these, purchase these, and keep the monitors in their states. And so that is an option for us. I believe you've been working with our federal delegation. But you also mentioned it seemed like there has been more attention by the federal government on the lower 48 and the resources in general than for Alaska, and we've been a bit behind the eight ball. Could you talk about that a little bit, please?
I would say that in the world of earthquakes, on the national level, Alaska is often treated as a backwater. I won't lie. We stand in line behind quite a number of other states, and despite the very real risks to our population, to our infrastructure, we do have a lower population. We are a bit different in many ways, and I think this story is one that's true across a whole lot of different industries and applications in the state. We don't fit the national mold sometime. So absolutely, I'm quite comfortable saying that there has been a chronic, over the decades, lack of investment at the federal level in the earthquake infrastructure, monitoring infrastructure in the state. I think that's undeniable.
And can you talk to us a little bit about your conversations with the delegation? Because this window of opportunity, they're going to start pulling these in 2020. Update us on those conversations.
Yeah, I will. So for the last few years, the university has had a very significant initiative to try and retain some subset of this network. Something like half. We've had excellent engagement at the federal level, quite a series of workshops, actually some initial funds from federal agencies. There's actually a considerable momentum from this, and our congressional delegation has been nothing short of outstanding in supporting this. We think there is a very real potential here to sustain this facility for long-term operation on through federal support of multiple different agencies. There are several different agencies using this data continuously live today in all of their in their to meet their missions. What I've got on the screen right here is probably a little hard to see in the room, but it describes this initiative and lays out some of the specific benefits to the state. There's a pile of posters just outside the door of specifically this. I would encourage you, everyone in the room, to take one, because if you don't take it, then I have to haul them back to Fairbanks this evening. So please don't be shy in taking them.
Would it be accurate to say that another silver lining of the November 30th earthquake is an increased awareness at the federal level, because your positive interactions with our delegation and the federal agencies was prior to November 30th. So I would think the November 30th earthquake might be a positive boost in that direction. Would you agree?
We have been working on this for many years. I gave a lunch and learn in this building in 2014 and talked about it. We've been hard at work with our federal delegation long, long, long before the November 30 earthquake. Yes, that earthquake ought to be instrumental in helping build the case. Quite honestly, between the holidays and the federal shutdown, we have not had as much interaction with our federal partners as we might have otherwise. But not a day goes by that there are not substantial conversations at fairly high levels with NOAA, USGS, National Science Foundation, et cetera.
Thank you. Senator Machicki.
You talked about roughly half. It just looks like there's about 185. I excluded the stations out of Canada. Is that the approximate number, 185 in Alaska?
Your count is probably better than mine is. Yes, exclude the Canadian ones. Something approximately 80 is what, if we retained roughly 80, that would begin to put us on par. That would put us on par with basic capabilities across the lower 48. That's been our talking point. So I won't dwell on it, but there is a capital request in the university's budget this year, a request also predating the November 30 earthquake, I'd like to point out, that includes essentially starter funds on this. I don't know how else to capture that. The diagram, the budgetary diagram that you have in front of you, shows what we envision in federal support in yellow, building out after a few years to full coverage from federal agencies. It has been a heavy lift, I will not lie, and the capital request that will come is in the university's budget now. Is essentially intended to help over the first few years bring in the full support of federal agencies. I'm going to move on. I just have a couple of slides left, and I wanted to focus for a moment on the transportation aspects, a couple of points that I think are important as we move into the next set of presentations. One's a very simple idea. I just want to reinforce that our building codes, whatever we're building, those codes are ultimately premised on the seismic data, the history of earthquakes, the ones that we know, the ones that caught us by surprise that I talked about earlier. Over time, takes a few years, but those all work their way officially into the codes and the building requirements. Second take-home point, as we all do sort of lessons learned from November 30, I don't want us to forget the tsunami component of this. This figure is a little bit hard to see on the screen, I apologize, but this is a blow-up of Seward, and what I want to point out is that the main road in and out of Seward is well within the tsunami zone, and I want that on our radar because tsunamis and earthquakes are often treated as two different natural hazards, but here in Alaska they're part of the same bad day. So as we think about response and how we deal with our transportation system and whatnot, it's worth considering, worth keeping in the back of our mind. We said earlier the next earthquake will look very different. It's very, you know, it's certainly plausible that the next significant event could include, you know, a tsunami component that is a completely different beast than what we're dealing with from November 30. The third point that I would make is the importance of instrumental recordings. If we want to know whether Eagle River shook harder than downtown Anchorage, we really can't do that unless we're actually recording data. And in order to do that, you've got to have instruments there at the time. This is actually a very easy thing to do in 2019. It needn't be. It can be quite cost effective. This is a map of Fairbanks. It shows the monitoring network in and around Fairbanks. And I used this as an example because many of these are actually at schools, and it shows the way that we can kind of partner and do double duty. A, we get better monitoring data, and B, we learn about particular facilities. We do have a handful of bridges that are instrumented in this state. They're not generally through us. They're generally through the U.S. Geological Survey, but there are a handful that are out there. As we move forward and look at how to do things better, I would recommend that we find key places to include instrumentation so that we have cold, hard data to work with. That is not my personal recommendation alone. That's a policy recommendation from the Seismic Hazard Safety Commission a few years ago that they put out, and I've got print copies of this policy recommendation outside if anybody is interested. And
Dr. West, correct me if I'm wrong, but did I hear that there were no monitors in Eagle River, Chugiak, or just not in any of their schools?
No, that is correct. We have no instrumental recordings from
at all.
Chugiak we do. We have one in there's one in Chugiak, I believe, and at the fire station. And I don't believe we have anything in Eagle River. So when you see those maps of shaking, which we'll see again in a few minutes, those are based on point measurements put together with the, I'll call it sophisticated interpolation, you know, using, we've got some algorithms that we use behind the scenes to try to estimate. But they are estimates. Nothing replaces actually measuring that.
Did I understand that you were checking on instrument that was located in this building today that was put in 50 years ago?
An hour and a half ago, I was in jeans and a T-shirt down in the boiler room with John Casey a couple of months ago, also prior to the earthquake. They uncovered back in the corner of the boiler room an instrument. We're going to go home, and I got to do a little forensic work, but my suspicion is that it dates to the late 60s. So the key take-home point is this building was instrumented in the late 1960s. Now it's not. We'll fix that headed forward. But it is an example of, instrumenting key facilities.
You have a question, Senator Michicki?
I do. Just page 25.
Forgive me.
I'll tell you. My next one forward.
Oh, forward, sorry.
Next one. There you go.
There you go.
So from the basement through fifth floor, I'm a commercial fisherman. When it's really rough, when I'm sitting on the flying bridge, the boat's not moving, the ocean's moving. But because the ocean is moving, it intensifies the distance that it travels. Is that the same thing with the building? Is it, I mean, the ground's moving, but there must be a lag on how the higher it is, the more intense the motion?
Through the chair, you're looking at the five recordings from the UAF engineering building on this that get progressively larger to the fifth floor. That's seen time and again in not just buildings but other structures. There are the better examples of this actually are from Anchorage. Anchorage has several buildings which are well instrumented, the Atwood building at various levels, the Hilton actually, and if I'm off the top of my head, I believe the recordings at the top of the Hilton were three times what they were at the base. Now, that's absolutely expected. Engineers designed for that. They're built that way. But, their buildings absolutely sway. And I think the analogy of being on the bridge of a ship is quite apropos.
Continue.
All right. That's really it. I hit on my last talking point here earlier, which is just, it's very important. The next earthquake, whatever it is, will not be a repeat of November 30th. So while we have all sorts of excellent learning opportunities right now, we need to be careful not to think of how to plan for that specific event. It will be different. Very simple idea, but I'd like to keep it in mind. And that's the end of my comments.
Well, thank you, Dr. West, and thank you for your work. It was extremely informative. And at this time, I'd like to invite the Department of Transportation and Public Facilities up to the table and welcome the Central Regional Director, Dave Kemp, along with the Facility Services Project Manager, Chris Hodgen. And if there are specific questions, we also have Rich Pratt, the Chief Bridge Engineer, and Mark Davis, the Facility Services Director, who is, I believe, on the phone, if I'm not mistaken. Is that correct that Mark is on the phone? Yes, I'm getting a nod. So, gentlemen, thank you for coming today. Please introduce yourselves, your name for the record, and proceed with your presentation.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Dave Kemp. I'm the Central Region Director, and I was the Incident Commander for the Department of Transportation and Public Facilities for the November 30th earthquake.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Christopher Hodgen, and I'm a project manager with the Division of Facility Services.
So the earthquake for me started last March. I was at the Homer King Derby down in Homer, and my phone started melting in my hand. And the reason for that was because of the bridge strike on Eagle River Bridge. And what I realized during that time period was that we weren't properly prepared for an emergency like that. Excellent. So we started training. Immediately after that, we started using the FEMA Incident Command Structure, or the Incident Command System. And basically, this is a way to divide up the responsibilities during an incident and to practice those ahead of time so that when an incident occurs, you're ready to go. So what we started doing was we took training, and then we started to use that training. We did tabletops, which is when you go into a room, someone comes up with a disaster that no one knows about, and you go into the room and you decide, how are we going to deal with this disaster? Who's going to be the incident commander? Who's going to be our public information officer? Who's going to be in charge of construction, design, all those types of things? So we did those. And then we also took minor incidents like avalanches, some flooding, additional bridge strikes, which there seems to be a multitude of lately for some reason. And we started using our incident command structure to practice during those incidents.
Mr. Kemp, the incident command center, where did you locate that? Did you actually use DMVA's Emergency Operations Center, or were you located in Anchorage, or where was the physical location?
Madam Chair, we set that up in the DOT upside down, the aviation building.
Oh, by the airport?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, thank you.
So November 30th happened. The slide on the left is my deputy director's office, and this was the only time she was fortunate to be in a meeting with me in my office, because my office was two doors down and had almost no damage. Had she been in her desk, she would have been, I think, seriously injured. And on the right here is the Mirror Lake part of the Glen Highway that was severely damaged by the earthquake.
You know, I'll just have to interject. When I see pictures like this and know that there were not injuries, it just makes me think somebody's looking out for Alaskans. The fact that there was not a vehicle that went, you know, was in that section of the road, the fact that your employee was not sitting at that desk. I just have seen so many examples since we've had the earthquake conversation the last couple of days, and it just makes me incredibly grateful.
Madam Chair, there were actually skid marks near this hole where someone just barely missed going into this hole. And, of course, we'll be looking at some slides later on Minnesota, the exit there, and there was one vehicle that ended up in the middle, and they were very fortunate too. So you're absolutely correct. We were very fortunate in a lot of different ways. So November 30th, 8:29, 7.0 earthquake, followed minutes later by a 5.7. We immediately evacuated the building, and then my deputy and I went back through the building and cleared the building to make sure no one was still there. The first DOT Facebook post was at 8:44. At 9:30, we set up our emergency operations center in the building, and it was up and running. At 10:15, we had traffic control and the Anchorage Police Department on-site at Minnesota and International. And 2 hours after the earthquake struck, we had repairs started on Minnesota at International. And by 11:08, we had an earthquake web page up and running to be able to inform the public of what was going on here. And I will say something about the Minnesota and International site. I have a friend who lives in Talkeetna. He saw a picture of that. He drove down a few days later, and he was upset with me because we'd already repaired it. And I said to him, I said, well, it feels normal now. We're getting complaints from the public.
Yeah.
Next slide, please. So this is our incident command center. For some reason, this is not showing the whole thing here.
Oh, Senator Michiki.
Thank you. Back on the timeline.
Back
did
one.
You? Is there a currently existing website, or so you said started? The website was up and running. Is there one that's just always there, where the public is informed where to go when the next earthquake occurs, and was it in existence before the earthquake?
Senator Michiki, through the chair, we have a website that is up all the time, along with Facebook and Twitter and a lot of other things that I'm not familiar with. We have a public information officer who is on top of that stuff and is putting out, whether it's a flood or an avalanche or whatever it is, we have that out there all the time. So this is the incident command structure. So again, I was the incident commander during the daytime. We had another incident commander at night. We also had a public information officer, someone in charge of construction, maintenance, contracting, and design. So we were up and running 2 hours after the event, and we were running 24/7 after that. Go ahead.
And because you had rehearsed and practiced, it went pretty smoothly as far as this setup, or did you learned something that you're adding to your list as far as for the next need?
Madam Chair, we will be, there's a slide here that talks about the hot wash where we went in and looked at what we did and what we needed and didn't have. So we'll be talking about that here in just a second.
Great, thanks.
But I was confident, this was the first time I'd ever been an incident commander, but I was confident in doing that because I've got quite a number of people on my staff who are former military. They had been through the incident command training. They had been through incident commands themselves. So I knew if I started misstepping, they would step in really quickly and tell me, hold on here, let's not do that. As an example, when I was getting ready to shut down the 24/7 incident command center, I asked the whole table, I said, are we ready to do this? And everybody agreed we were going from incident command to project management. And so we had a good transition there.
Senator Keel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So if the rest of the upside down building looked like your deputy's office, do you have a series of contingent locations for your incident command, and are they properly wired for what you need to do? How long is that list?
Senator Keel, through the chair, our building, we showed you the worst picture of the worst office. Actually, it's kind of interesting talking about different houses in different neighborhoods because downstairs had very little damage at all. Very, very few bookshelves fell over or anything else. What we did have is have Mr. Hodgins' group come over from public facilities and go through our facility to make sure we were okay. One of the concerns was air quality. I know my deputy and I walked through the whole building to clear it. And one of the things we have on our list that we didn't have were masks, because we both walked through that building. We spent about an hour clearing out that building, breathing in who knows what. But we had the air tested so that we were clear, and we had it structurally inspected so that we knew that that was a fairly safe place to be. Our second location actually fared worse than the main location, which is the annex. Where public facilities is located, that was supposed to be our fallback, and they actually suffered more damage than we did.
So one fallback.
Yes.
And do you have incident command plans and locations determined for the other regions of the state? I know your central region, but are you aware of the other regions?
I'm not aware of their plans. I am aware, as an example, the nighttime incident commander was our MNO chief from South Coast, from here in Juneau. He flew up because he had quite a bit of experience doing this. So this was an effort that had Northern Region, South Coast, and Central Region all getting together and working as a team, because we had some holes that, you know, we had to have a nighttime and a daytime, and then all the other people to go with it. So we needed people from all the regions to come together to make this successful.
Well, since we're serving Alaskans statewide, would you be able to find out for us so that we know the whole state is covered as far as having this kind of arrangement ready to take off the shelf and use in the event of a disaster?
Yes, ma'am.
Please, thank you. Senator Michicki.
So you're ICS structure here is not very traditional. It looks more fit for purpose compared to the military ICS structure. Is this sort of a model that's kind of more national in the DOT kind of response versus the more military ICS?
Senator Michicki, through the chair, this is directly from FEMA, and I took six classes. One of them was a two-day class. The 100, 300, 500, 700, there's another one in there somewhere. My entire leadership team took all those classes, and their FEMA put together their FEMA certification, and FEMA certifies the people who teach the classes too. So it is a little different, and you're absolutely correct. We had, again, I've got folks on my team who are former military, and they're like, this is a little different. It all works. Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
So our next steps were, number one, determine the extent of the damage. Number two, prioritize which work we're going to do. Number three, communicate the priorities with the team, which is our staff, consultants, and contractors. And then lastly, communicate with the public. And I'll go through a little bit of detail about all four of these here in just a second. So the extent of the damage, we had five sources of information. Number one was our maintenance staff who were out there. And I would like to say we had one gentleman, Steve Bansi, who used to be our maintenance chief out in the valley. He was retired, and he came out of retirement and went out on his own and did inspections because he knows those bridges, he knows those roads, and he was calling in to us, giving us updates the day of and the next day afterwards. That kind of tells you what kind of an organization we have when people who are retired jump in and try to help out here. We also had bridge inspections. We have Rich Pratt here who can, we're going to be talking a little bit about bridges, and if we get into anything technical, I'm going to turn around to him. Our construction teams were out there. Our consultant teams were out there, and of course we were getting information from the public on, hey, something's going on here, can you go look at it? So we were responding to all five of those different inputs on where's the damage. And then we prioritized the work. Currently we have a little over 160 locations. This is a map that shows some of those locations. There's obviously a key that goes with this that identifies number 53 is at this location. Here's the damage that we've assessed there. The one thing I will say, and I'll talk a little bit about it in a second here, is we have 180 days from FEMA to identify and to start working on repairs. Because we're in the middle of the winter, we asked for an extension on that because right now everything's covered with snow and it's almost impossible to see not only what the original damage was, but what the aftershocks did. So we've gotten the okay to get another 90 days on top of that, which will put us well into the summer. We should be able to, because we don't want to leave something we find out in a year that we had damage and we didn't, you know, take advantage of this disaster declaration.
Mr. Kemp, we all know what happens at breakup time and how there are additional potholes and things like that. Are you expecting things that, even where there maybe the snow has cleared off and it looks fine now, is there a chance that with the breakup that there'll be a different kind of level of damage than what we see in a typical spring?
Madam Chair, I think we are going to see a lot more damage. I know I commute from Bayshore to the Aviation Building every morning, and there are additional little bumps and humps along that part of Minnesota that were never there before. And those are not ones we're out trying to do repairs on now because we have so many other things we're dealing with right now. But I think you're absolutely right. And then there's also things that are maybe not right on the road, slope stability, culverts that might have been damaged, stuff like that. So I'm concerned about the level of work we're going to have in front of us here in a very short time. I'll be talking a little bit about how we're ramping up resources to try to deal with that. So communicating with the team and staff, consultants and contractors, one of the things we found when we did some of these tabletops was that, and you find this when you look back at the Trade Center disasters or any of those other types of things, one of the real key issues is the ability of folks to communicate with each other. What we found out is that our ability to use radios, which is our fallback, if cell phones don't work, if email doesn't work, then radios are our fallback. We found that, like, I had a radio in my vehicle that I drive quite a bit, but I didn't know how to get onto the channel that would get onto the DMVA. So we did practices on get out in the vehicle, here's how you're going to do it, here's where you press, and then we put instructions in the vehicles and on the handheld so people knew when they picked them up, here's how you use these things. Because you can have the smartest people in the world, but if we can't communicate with each other, we're not going to be able to get the job done. So communicating with the public, we have a public information officer, Shannon McCarthy, who is absolutely on top of this stuff, and she was on social media and updating the web page, and I think she did, in my opinion, just an excellent job of keeping everybody informed as much as we possibly could. Okay. So this is Minnesota Drive. This is actually northbound, and I'm not sure we got southbound in there, but this is northbound. I actually drove this about 2 hours before this, and then at 8:29, this is what happened. I'm sure you've all seen this picture. Next one. And then this is December 4th, 2018. I have had a lot of different experiences in my career. It's unfortunate we had an earthquake, But I have to tell you, this was the most fun I've ever had at work, because we got to do things without permits, without reviews, without budgets, without anything. And it was a blast. It really was a lot of fun to be able to do this and to lead a team of people who really were dedicated to making sure we could do this as quickly as possible. This is Willow Fishhook. And going back, Madam Chair, to your earlier comment about we're going to be seeing additional things. If you look on the left of this slide, this is the before slide, and you can see a crack going along the slope there. There's damage to the asphalt, but there's also damage to that slope that supports that. And if you look on the right, we've gone in there and we've done some repairs. We put in some grass that hopefully will grow this spring. But one of the things I want to make sure everybody's aware of is those repairs we did, 99.9% of them we're going to have to go back and do again, because we were doing those in the wintertime. We were paving when no one's ever paved before. That any of the contractors I've worked with have said that they paved in that kind of temperature. And we were fortunate at the time that we didn't have a whole lot of snow on the ground when that earthquake happened. Had we been, you know, like it is in Juneau today, that would have been a whole different result from that earthquake.
Senator Michicki.
So I'm going to have a question later about bridges, but on these, seems like there might be some commonality between the damaged sections of highway. And I know you had to go in and do the repairs that you did, but how much time did you spend on understanding the factors that related to the failures to avoid them with different construction standards in the future, which is probably the key between 64 was a much strong earthquake, but obviously we updated our standards and have more survivable construction today and the different types of construction. Did you take enough time to understand what caused the failure and how you would change that construction in the future?
Senator Michicki, through the chair, what we're going to be doing is when we go back, because we didn't have time to do this when we did the immediate repairs, we're going to be doing geotechnical investigations along these locations to do two things. Number one, answer the question that you just asked. And number two, to make sure that when we do the permanent repair, it is a permanent repair. And we're going to be looking at a few other things structurally, like with bridges, that kind of go to that question too, I believe.
Just a follow-up?
Well, I mean, I might as well ask the bridge question now. I mean, in 64, the earthquake, I think every Turnagain Arm bridge failed. And we learned a lot from the L.A. Interstate pancake bridges. And that's a really complicated relationship, VSM versus horizontal structures, right, working against each other. Is that something we'll be looking at? Not only, I know there wasn't a lot of bridge damage in this particular situation, but is that something you'll be evaluating as well?
Senator Michicki, through the chair, I guess I'd defer to Richard Pratt on this. He's our bridge expert. We're going to be, there's a section here that talks about bridges, so perhaps he can come up and deal with that. Otherwise, I'll be making
Before you turn
answers.
That slide, I noticed that these photographs are all aerial. Were you using, sending up small planes to survey in those first few hours, the first day or two, using drones, a combination, like you said, we were lucky with the weather, because that could have been a deterrent to be able to get up and assess. But what did you use for the
Madam Chair, we most of these photos are with drones, and we have started using drones. I know Northern Region was kind of the leader on that, and we started using drones a lot more in Central Region. This is exactly the type of places where it comes in really handy, where we don't have to put somebody in the air at a very high expense, and we're actually putting drones at every one of our maintenance stations so that when something like this happens, we don't have to wait for somebody to go out there. Now, that involves training. That involves making sure that we're following all the rules and everything else. But this makes this type of activity so much easier. We can then, at the Incident Command Center, we can then see someone's talking about something. We can actually see exactly what they're talking about without having them trying to describe it. The other thing we're doing is using something called Survey 123, which is an application that allows you to use a cell phone or a laptop to take a picture of something, because a lot of times in these type of events, someone's saying, well, I'm on the north side of this bridge and I'm seeing this. And it turns out they're actually on the south side and they're seeing something. And that can really create a lot of chaos. Whereas with this survey 123, you take a picture of it, it tells you exactly where you are with you know, GPS coordinates, so that you don't have to figure out where exactly are those. So a lot of this technology that we're starting to use now really came in handy when we were working on this.
Mr. Lessman may or may not remember, but I remember being in a transportation finance subcommittee probably 4 years ago and really encouraging DOT to begin to use the drone. So I'm glad to see that happened and being put to good use.
So this is the Glen Highway at Mirror Lake. This is one that was actually didn't get as much press as I think as the Minnesota International one got, but this one was a huge issue for us. We were concerned because we had excavators down in that hole, and we were concerned about losing both the northbound and the southbound lane, because you can see all this material sloughed off, and we had excavators down in there. We were concerned about the excavators and the people in the excavators, number one. But number two, we were concerned about not only the southbound lane, but also this could possibly have sloughed off and we would have lost both lanes. So this was a high-risk endeavor that we took on here to get this thing repaired as quickly as we did. But again, I can't say enough about the contractors in Alaska. And part of, I'm going to talk a little bit about, we got questions from all over the U.S. from other DOTs on how the heck did you do this? And one of the keys there is our working relationship with the contractors and the contractors' attitudes, and I think who we are as Alaskans, because we know if something like this happens, the county next door or the state next door isn't coming, or if they're coming, it's going to be a long time till they get here. So it's get her done here, and that's what we saw here more than anything else. Okay. So this is the Glen Parks interchange. As you can see on the right there, there's probably almost a foot of settlement, and this obviously doesn't allow people to drive on that part of the, that was one of the lanes. Again, we had contractors, and again, if you look on the left, again, you can see the slope on the side of the road there. That you don't see if you're driving along there, but that's areas that we have to go in and again, do the geotechnical exploration and figure out what happened there. Why did it fail here and not, you know, 100 yards back or 100 yards up? Was there something in the compaction there, or, you know, what was it? Sometimes we may not ever really find out the exact reason. Maybe it's just because that's where the earth shook more than 100 yards away. I don't know, but we're definitely going to go in and do some exploring and try to figure out why did it fail right there. This is the northbound Eagle River Bridge. Again, I can't say enough about contractors. They got out there and milled this down so that, you know, we could have road traffic back on this bridge fairly quickly. And this is just one I put in there because there's a lot of these all over the place. And again, if there's an inch of snow, you'll never see this. So these are ones we tried to identify as many as we could while there wasn't any snow. But we'll be going back and looking at all the different locations. And again, the public, contractors, consultants, our M&O crews will all be feeding us with information about where these things are. Okay. This is the Briggs Bridge out in Eagle River. And on the left there, you can see this is a pedestrian tunnel that was blown up by an 8-inch water line. And again, we are incredibly fortunate that there wasn't someone in that when this happened. I actually went there and saw this thing, and it was amazing how the force of water did this. But we're working with AWU on getting this repaired and getting that tunnel back opened and getting the bridge open again too.
And what is that acronym, AWWU?
I'm sorry, Anchorage Water and Wastewater Utility.
Thank you.
We're not supposed to have any acronyms in here, and I missed that one. Next slide. So this is Seward Highway Rockfall. Obviously, the earthquake brought down a lot of additional rock, and plus, in the last few years, we've had a lot more freeze-thaw cycles than we have in the past. And if you look at the picture on the right, that's just one example of the challenges we have out there. We've got a lot of vertical faces that go up for hundreds and hundreds of feet. And a challenge is how to deal with that. And right now we have at least three projects that we're doing on that corridor. And we're also having a landslide consultant, and I believe that's actually their name is Landslide Incorporated or something. We have them on one of our projects, and because of this, we've asked them to come and look at this and tell us, are there things we can do in the interim? Because to cut this back, you're talking millions and millions of dollars to cut that back. Plus, there's all kind of issues with permits and whatnot. But this is another area of, you know, that we had significant, you know, issues out there, and our crews got out there fairly quickly and got the road opened. And we're almost daily dealing with additional rocks falling down there. Okay. This is one I'm really proud of. This is Vine Road out in the Mat-Su, and I believe I wasn't in the room in the Mat-Su when this happened, but somebody there said, hey, look at what they're doing. Can we get them to come do our road for us? And so they asked, and I talked to our new commissioner, and he said, sure. So we went out, and the next slide. And I believe, I'm not positive, but I believe what you see on top of that road is a little bit of fog created by the heat from the paving that we did there. And I'm still amazed at the striping they did. It's like, it's amazing. They not only paved it in the winter, but they striped it in the winter. But anyway, so we worked with the Mat-Su on this. We said, yeah, we can go do that for you, and we did. And again, this one will probably most likely need to be rebuilt. And I'd be curious on this one, going back to your question about why did it happen here. If you look at this, the topography here, and if you back up, we've kind of cut this slide off a little bit. But it didn't fail there up in the woods. It didn't fail on this side, which is in the woods. It failed, which looks to me like a bit of a slough type of thing down in there. So there's probably some unstable soils in there. But again, we're going to need to go in and do some geotechnical investigation and find out what happened there and why did it happen.
Senator Machicki.
Yeah, I mean, just from, and this was something I looked at early on, was the, seems like it's beyond, if there's some sort of a liquefaction standard or something, I mean, it's obvious where this failed. It seems like you might have to reevaluate where a bridge versus, you know, paved ground-based highway is applicable. And I don't know if you saw that in other places. I know the Sterling Highway on the Kenai, that section of highway, which has not been repaved, I better mention, because I hear about that every day. Just seems like that might be one of those places you reevaluate. But that's not my job. That's yours. It just looks like this is a prime candidate for that evaluation.
Certainly. So one of the things we did is something called a hot wash, which is, what could we do better? So we had three meetings, and we sat down and went through all the things that we didn't have. And one example is we didn't have a large map that we had that we could just, you know, write on and erase and whatever in our main conference room where we had our incident command center. That was one of many, many things that we didn't have. We didn't have masks for those who have to go through the building afterwards. We didn't have a sniffer to make sure that we didn't have a gas leak in the building. There were a lot of things there that we didn't have that we're going to be working on. So the next slide shows.
And will you be sharing those items with the other regions?
Yes,
that
ma'am.
They can review, make sure they have them. Thank you.
Except the Wi-Fi password. They don't get that.
Okay. So current activities. First thing we're doing is we're identifying additional damage due to the earthquake and aftershocks. That's an ongoing thing. Second thing, we requested additional support to deliver our normal program and all the additional earthquake work. That request has been submitted. We requested a 90-day extension from FEMA, Federal Emergency Management Agency, in addition to the 180 days, which they usually give for earthquake damage, and we got that approved. We're currently accounting and negotiating for all that work we did without any contracts. And there's one more below that or not? Yes. And then we're establishing contracts for all the 160 locations that we've identified. That's ongoing. We got the FEMA, the president signed the FEMA disaster declaration, which was well received. And then, just so you know, currently we have contracts underway for the work that we've been doing. As of yesterday morning, $7.27 million for the work we've been doing. But again, a lot of that work, we'll have to go back, take it out, and redo it when the temperatures and the climate is a little better than it is right now.
Do you know, do those FEMA dollars come directly through you and bypass the legislative appropriation process? You don't need, do you need federal program receipts to receive those, or is that just direct to you?
Madam Chair, I'd need Mary Sirocki next to me to answer that question.
Thank you.
We will get back to you on that. Next slide. So, other data, this is one of the parts of my job that I really loved. Two of the things that happened. Number one, there was a Caltrans engineer down in the Bay Area who was asked, how did they do that up in Alaska? And he was explaining incorrectly how we did it. That made my day right there. And then the second thing was Snopes, that website that disproves or proves facts, had to do an analysis to see if we didn't just, we're a bunch of Alaskans up here in the dark winters photoshopping our roads and saying we had done this stuff in, you know, a few days. And they had to actually put out a release that said, yes, we actually did do those. So the questions we get from the other DOTs is, how did you do this? Well, as I said before, last spring we realized we weren't sufficiently prepared. So we undertook training and we practiced what we learned in our training. Most importantly, though, I think we have a very close working relationship and trust with our contracting community, because Alaska is not a very big place. So we had contractors who were ready, able, and willing to go to work immediately on a handshake, and that's all it was. And it actually, in talking to Joel St. Aubin, who's the head of my construction, I was talking to him yesterday about how much have we contracted out and how many change orders do we have. And he said to me, he said, well, here's what we have. And he said, you know, it's going really well. He said, we're not getting a lot of, you know, unreasonable claims and that kind of stuff. And when you think about it, I mean, the contractors went out there almost as soon as the shaking stopped and started heating up the oil so they could make asphalt, because everything was like a block. The second thing they did was they contacted all their paving operators, all their folks who ran their paving plants, who were spread hither and yon around the lower 48 and Hawaii and wherever, and had them fly back here to get ready to do this. Lastly, as I said before, as Alaskans, we know if we don't get it done, it's not going to, we can't sit here and wait for someone else to come in and do it. So those are the reasons I think that this was fairly successful effort.
Mr. Kemp, we're coming up against the clock. If you could just point out a few key points on the next couple of slides so that we have a chance to bring Rich up and a little discussion on the bridges.
Yes, ma'am. That's it. I'm done.
Oh, okay. Senator Keel, is your question for Mr. Kemp?
It is. Thank you.
Okay.
Madam Chair, so, Mr. Kemp, I mean, I think you explained a bunch of the challenges that contractors will have. I would expect the bills to be a little higher for this kind of work than they would be in the summertime when you've had lots of time to plan and people are moved up anyway. I mean, in a ballpark, how much higher should we expect these costs to be, and above which point should we worry? And you don't need to drag Ms. Sirocki in here, but just order of magnitude.
Senator Keel, through the chair, I can't give you a percentage, but what I can tell you is that Joel St. Aubin, who's been doing this for about 25 years, told me that what he's getting, he considers to be reasonable for the effort that had to be put forth there. In other words, you know, it's anytime you start a new job, there's a mobilization cost. Well, this was a mobilization cost times, you know, quite a bit, because you're having to start up, dewinterize, and then you're going to have to rewinterize it when you're done. So, but I haven't looked into the exact numbers, but I do trust my head of construction, who told me what we're seeing looks reasonable to me, considering what these folks did.
I appreciate that. Maybe could we get a follow-up, maybe when those numbers are starting to crystallize a little?
Certainly, if you could provide that. I know you have a little bit on facilities. Did you want to give us a few key points on that, Mr. Hodgin, before we bring Mr. Pratt up?
Madam Chair, I'd be proud to do that. So, I'm very proud to be part of the department and to to present alongside Mr. Kemp and Mr. Davis, and very, very privileged to share the actions of the men and women of the division. So we'll talk about overview of the response metrics, high-level look at the damage and repair efforts, and then next steps moving forward.
And it's going to have to be pretty brief because we're down to about 9 minutes. So.
It will be brief.
Thank you.
Yeah. So our immediate actions, we accounted for our team, welfare, and safety check. That helped us understand who we would need for our response center. So we assembled a response center at our facility's annex to liaison with the DOT headquarters response center. So we included support personnel from Anchorage, Fairbanks, and Juneau. Simultaneously, we deployed our facilities maintenance people to do rapid evaluations of the facilities and then to ascertain the immediate repairs necessary to open the facilities as soon as possible. So that first night, we had our operations manager join us from Fairbanks, Pete Bonin, and Anna Enge, our project coordinator, join us from Juneau. Prioritizing the facilities was a big step. What we did was compile the facilities based on the affected intensity zones, understand what those facilities were, and then started with the assessments on the critical facilities, those facilities that were occupied 24/7, like the API and McLaughlin Youth Center. So those were the first steps for the prioritizations. The immediate repairs were initiated by our facilities technicians and maintenance personnel partnered with the local contractors. Some of the facilities that they went out to do repairs included our headquarters building, our DOT annex, the Boney Courthouse, and others. The contractors involved janitorial contractors, mechanical and electrical contractors, and environmental contractors. So the majority, it was because of these efforts that the majority of the buildings of our state buildings were ready to be occupied within 4 days after the event. So our safety assessment, simultaneous to that, we had incredible help doing the safety assessments. So these safety assessments teams comprised of architects, engineers, our divisional staff, volunteer engineers from the Structural Engineering Association of Alaska, and out-of-state engineers from North Carolina and California that came out to render assistance. So we utilized those to do these safety inspections in all of the facilities. These inspections followed the nationally recognized ATC 20 protocols. So these are post-earthquake detailed evaluation procedures. And what that allowed for was the consistent posting of the buildings, so inspected being great, being green, restricted use being yellow, and unsafe being red. So on the right-hand side is a timeline of all of the activities that happened within the first 2 weeks of this event. We also provided support to some of the partner agencies, including the Mat-Su Borough and Kenai Peninsula Borough for some of their public buildings. Our response metrics, we had strong collaboration with our partner agencies, so every day we had daily stakeholder communications that we would provide the update on the building inspections and repair statuses. The detailed safety assessment results, our teams inspected 369 state facilities. So at the peak, we had about eight safety assessment teams. So these teams would comprise of structural engineers, other engineers, and our volunteer engineers. We did assistance to facilities in the Mat-Su Borough and the Kenai Peninsula Borough and others, and the majority of the state facilities were found to be green. 13 were designated as yellow with restricted use for our state facilities, and none were designated as red. So the high-level damage and repair overview, the damage summary, for our state facilities, the most significant damage was in my office building, the annex. So a few feet down from my office is actually a crack down in the floor. So that's the building that had the most damage. Some other buildings with significant damage included the Boney Courthouse and our DOT headquarters. The majority of buildings that we saw in the Anchorage area, Mat-Su and Kenai Peninsula Borough, comparatively sustained lesser damage. And when I talk about these buildings, these are our state public buildings. The common damage that we saw included concrete masonry unit construction, damage to the ceiling grid, and sheetrock cracks. So as of this moment, we've done temporary repairs. The permanent repairs, our current estimates are in the range of $6 million to $10 million. And as we continue to discover more, we'll update that. We are currently working with our risk management office and the state emergency office to coordinate this repair work. The timelines for the repair work will vary a little bit depending on the severity, my office being the one with the most severe damage, the processes and requirements of the different funding sources.
All right, thank you. I know there's one more page, but I think members can kind of scan that and see, and I'd like to ask Mr. Rich Pratt to come on up so that Senator Machicki can ask his question regarding bridges. Okay, I didn't know what you're scheduled. Oh, Senator Machicki, you have, actually introduce yourselves, and why don't you make a general opening statement about what you've learned about the bridges, and then maybe Senator Machicki will ask his question.
Certainly. My name is Rich Pratt. I'm the chief bridge engineer with the Alaska DOT. I've been in that position since the year 2000. I have something like 35 years experience in bridge engineering. I guess my overall reaction was we got pretty lucky in this event because a magnitude 7 event's a big event. We could have had a lot more damage than we did, but the bridges actually came through quite well.
If you want to hit the arrow, you actually do have a slide. There you go.
Okay. So I just put together some information about what we did responding. So we responded out of Juneau and Fairbanks. The bridge office is here in Juneau. We had a bridge maintenance crew in Fairbanks that drove down, and they teamed up with our staff and got out there. I will take the time right now to point out, in response to the senator's earlier question, our bridge inspection program that we routinely do every year, year in, year out, is performed by our bridge design engineers. So the team leaders who responded after the earthquake were all professional engineers who design bridges the vast majority of the time. The rest of the time during the summer months, they might spend a couple weeks at a time out inspecting bridges on a regular basis. There's a couple benefits, but one of the primary ones here is we have all the reports on these bridges. We know them intimately. We look at them every 24 months as a maximum time frame. Sometimes we're looking at them annually, so we have a lot of information about them to start with. The rest of the preparation was just making sure we weren't going to be a burden to people and that our staff was prepared. You can't look at a bridge by sitting behind the steering wheel in a truck like you might on the highway. So people had to be ready to get out there in the cold all day long, had to bring their ice cleats so they could get down under the bridge, not slide or fall.
Mr. Pratt, was your team also involved with the March Eagle River Bridge incident?
Yes, one of my colleagues and I made the determination that the highway needed to be closed in that incident, and we had an inspector in Anchorage that day who responded immediately, and we sent one of our engineers that night who took over the engineering responsibilities for that repair or reopening of the Glen Highway. The same thing again on the Tudor overcrossing last month when it was struck by the dump truck. So
your team's been busy this last year.
Yeah, people call us and we respond. In the case of the earthquake, we sent four teams up there, so four team leaders, a couple of engineering assistants, and then, as I said, the maintenance folks from Fairbanks drove down and worked with us as well. They prioritized about 300 bridges needing inspections. They got those accomplished in over about a four-day period and didn't really find any significant damage. They prioritized those inspections by looking at the initial damage reports we got from Dave Kemp's maintenance people who had been out looking at things. That's our normal prescribed approach, is local maintenance is going to go out immediately after the event, try to identify anything significant, and let us know, and then we follow up right afterwards. So within, say, 24 to 48 hours, hopefully. Some of the other things, the obvious things, Glen Highway, Seward Highway, Minnesota Drive, high traffic routes, so those got prioritized. We considered age of the structures, whether the bridges had been previously strengthened to improve their seismic performance, bridges that we knew might have vulnerable details. Earlier in the conversation today, someone asked about that, is what do we put into the design? Well, yeah, it's known that some structural details are more vulnerable than others. And then the last thing was just if we had previous knowledge of an issue with a bridge. This graphic here was just to show the contours of ground shaking with bridge location superimposed over the top of it. I'm pretty sure this is one of the bridges out by Eagle River, and you can see the ground slip vertically about 16 inches at this location. The bridges are founded on deep foundations, so piling going down 50, 100, 150 feet into the ground, so down below the point where the soil was failing. This particular bridge is a relatively new bridge. It carries Dowling Road over the top of Arctic Boulevard in Anchorage, and this is a what we call a shear key. It's what we know when bridges collapse is the girders fall off their supports. So what you see in this picture are some steel tub girders, they call them. And you can see where that shear key is cracked and spalled, where it engaged due to the lateral load of the earthquake pushing it, trying to push it sideways. But it clearly kept the girders on the support. And it's also a fuse. Those of us who are a little older might remember fuses in the fuse box in our house that would sacrifice or fail before some more critical part of the infrastructure failed. These shear keys protect other parts of the bridge. So they protect the abutments and the piers and so on. So they're engaging them, but only engaging them to the point that they don't overload them. So this, I guess the good story here, relatively modern design. Force was attracted where we wanted it to be directed, and it did its job. So that was a pretty nice reward for us. At the time I put this slide together, I thought we had 25 bridges. I've now been corrected. It's down to 19 bridges. Our estimated repair costs very preliminarily are $860,000 for those 19 bridges. And it looks like that's the last of my slides. So, Senator Michicki, through the chair, I'll paraphrase your question again. In the 1964 earthquake, we had a lot of bridges collapse in Turnagain Arm, and we learned from that. In the 1970s and the 80s and 90s in California, when they had major earthquakes, there were bridges collapse, and we learned from that as well. As I said before, the key thing is keeping the girders on the abutments, on the piers, not on the ground. What we know is when girders fall to the ground, it's very unforgiving. It's if someone's underneath, they will not survive. And so that's the national design standard for bridges, is no collapse. And we follow those national design standards. Matter of fact, I chair the committee that writes the national standard for seismic design of bridges. One of my colleagues wrote two of the chapters of that standard about 10 years ago. So Alaska is actually leaders in this area. We were very fortunate that our bridges came through this well. I don't know how much we learned other than what we were doing seems to have worked in this event. I think it could have been otherwise, not because I think there's anything wrong or substandard in the way we do our designs, but just the earthquake was 30 miles deep. I think we saw a lot of ground shaking where the ground was disturbed. It doesn't appear that the structures were disturbed in the same way.
Do you have a question, Senator Michicki?
Well, thank you for that answer. That makes me a lot more comfortable. We live on the Kenai, even with there was an absence of connectivity issues, and we still ran out of food that day because of just things that were happening. Some shelves were bare. So when you think about a half dozen bridges failing, potentially, it's a concern. Thank you for that answer. The last one, is there like an internal struggle like on the Vine Road thing in DOT where is there an I told you so that should have been a bridge, or is that?
The Senator Michicki through the chair. I think we have had sites where soils could be so bad that we would in fact put in a structure, but to be fair about it, bridges are very, very expensive to construct compared to roadways. Roadways are just quite a bit less, you know, like I would say 10 times. I'm just grabbing a number off the top of my head, but 10 times as expensive, if not more. And there are things that can be done, but they are expensive. That bridge I showed earlier with the failed shear key, with the cracked shear key, we did ground improvement at that bridge when we constructed it 5-6 years ago, where they took and mixed cement into the soil down about 30 feet to improve the soil, and it really helped. But I think it was $3 million is what I was told, just for the two abutment sites, a relatively small area compared to a long stretch of road. I think there are other strategies that can be used. You can remove the vulnerable soil when you build the new road. And I'm sure that our geotechnical engineers consider that and optimize their designs based on that to the best of their ability.
Senator Michicki.
What it comes down to is a cost-benefit analysis in every case. I mean, you can build, you know, I've heard jokes about the black box in an airplane because they always survive. Why don't they build the entire airplane out of the same material, right? So it's just a cost-benefit analysis. Sometimes you just, the infrequent repair when there's serious seismic activity, you're just going to go in and fix some things, and others you can afford to design around.
I agree.
Fair.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you so much. I want to thank all the presenters. It was very enlightening. We appreciate the fact that you're looking back to learn from all that happened. It's reassuring to me, and I know to many Alaskans. So we're going to conclude. That concludes our business, and we're going to, on February 12th, meet at 1:30 here for consideration of the governor's appointee to the Marine Pilots Board and a presentation from the Alaska Railroad. And Senator Michicki, did you have something else?
I'm going to leave this up to you, Madam Chair, but for the public out there that sometimes complains about public employees, can you do a huge thank you to the Department of Transportation for that response?
Absolutely, absolutely. I see nodding from Senator Keel. We're very, very thankful for the DOT and the public facilities, all the employees, and we're so grateful that you were prepared. That made a huge difference. So even prior to November 30th, the work that went into getting up to speed and being ready, and we hope that's happening around the state. So with that, I will conclude our meeting at 3:08 p.m.